I'm very happy to welcome Thomas Guthrie. He's an associate professor of sociology and anthropology at Guilford College, and he's author of the book Recognizing Heritage, The Politics of Multiculturalism in New Mexico. And he will be speaking tomorrow night, Wednesday night, right here in Santa Fe at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you write about multiculturalism and colonialism and identity here in New Mexico. Why don't we start by talking about the meaning of some of those terms? First of all, what is colonialism? That's a word that has a lot of different meanings. How are you using it? What does it mean?
Oh, that's a great question, and that's a complicated one. Usually, when we think of colonialism, we think of one group of people dominating another group of people, oftentimes claiming their land and their resources. New Mexico has been colonized twice, first by the Spanish and second by the Americans. But I use colonialism also in a broader sense to refer not just to the appropriation of land and resources, but also the imposition of a culture. So, for example, when Americans arrived in New Mexico, they imposed their own language, their own laws. They required people to begin speaking English, to adopt American legal practices and culture. So colonialism has both cultural and economic and political and religious, all kinds of different dimensions to it.
When I think of colonialism, I always think that somewhere in the background it's always enforced, and that method of enforcement is usually violence, police, armies of some kind. Is that true?
I would say that's true, although if we think about the last 500 years of world history and the history of European colonialism, I think we can see around the world colonial force taking a lot of different forms. So, for example, when the Spanish colonized Mexico in the 1500s, guns were their major weapon against the indigenous peoples they were colonizing. And there are plenty of examples of colonizers using explicit forms of violence to get what they want. But as time went on, as the centuries progressed, I think the force and the violence became more subtle in a lot of ways. So, for example, if you think about the American colonization of New Mexico, it wasn't nearly as violent in terms of the use of guns and weapons as earlier colonial conquest had been. There are plenty of examples of colonizers going in and wiping out an entire population, and that basically didn't happen in New Mexico. But I do think that the American colonization of New Mexico was forceful. It just took different forms. So, for example, I think school policies can be a form of force. It's not explicitly violent, but if you are, for example, taking Native kids out of their homes and putting them in boarding schools in order to civilize them.
And punishing them brutally if they speak their language.
Exactly.
And things like that.
Exactly.
So there is violence in that.
There is, but there are also more subtle things, so that a lot of times the colonized start perpetuating the same power relations. So, for example, you would have people here in New Mexico who would discourage their children from speaking Spanish or Tewa or whatever native language they had because they thought that English was a better language. So that's an example of how colonialism can become internalized and the power relations become much more complicated.
And if you impose your system of laws on people who had a very different system before, as the Anglo-American legal system is different from the existing Spanish legal system in New Mexico, you've still got cops and jails to back it up.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
So let's talk about multiculturalism. And again, what are the different ways that that word is used? What does it mean as a concept and as a practice?
Sure. I think multiculturalism is a demographic fact. It is a fact that the United States is culturally, linguistically diverse. So in a certain sense, we are and always have been a multicultural nation. But I'm really interested in multiculturalism as a political movement that really began in the 1960s in the United States. It began quite a bit earlier in New Mexico, and I can say a little bit more about that. But when I mean multiculturalism as a political movement, I mean The idea that diversity is good and that government should support it and protect it and that we can benefit from cultural diversity. So we see, for example, multiculturalism in school celebrations where kids are going to dance performances and learning about diverse cultures. There was a time in American history when it was definitely assumed that cultural diversity was a bad thing and that the government should wipe out cultural diversity. So I think we're in a new moment now where we as a nation tend to view cultural diversity as a resource and as a good thing.
So that brings up yet another question about definitions, which is, what do we mean by culture? I mean, culture is huge, and I think one of the things that I find a little bit irritating about the way culture is used, it's basically, you know, well, my family ate chilies, and I'm from back east, and my family ate lasagna, as if that constituted culture. But culture is so much more than that. I mean, it's the way you live. It's the way, well, you tell us.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's so complicated. Ah, these are hard questions. You're really making me get back into my professor mode here.
Well, you're an anthropologist.
Right. So, wow, I have a lot to say about the idea of culture. Typically, I think you're right. Today, when people talk about culture, I think mostly they're thinking about dance, food, music, clothing, sort of the obvious expressive forms of our lives. Anthropologists tend to think about culture in a much broader way, like you're suggesting. So anthropologists tend to think of culture as being a body of knowledge that makes social life meaningful, and it can be anything as minute as knowing how far apart we should stand from each other when we're talking. That varies cross-culturally, to how we do things, how we build houses, how we spend our time, how we think of time. So it can be incredibly broad. But in the last few decades, there has been a pretty major critique of the idea of culture within academic anthropology, and a lot of anthropologists now argue that culture is a problematic concept, and it's ironic because anthropologists were some of the ones who first really popularized the notion of culture in the early 20th century. So there's a lot of academic conversation going on now about this idea of culture.
I think if you have the idea of culture as things like dance and food and that kind of expression, well, everybody has dance and food and that kind of expression. It's kind of like you can have lots of cultures living side by side and they all get along because they all do their separate dances. But if you start thinking about culture as how people view time, how people view the roles of men and women, how people view land, how people view work, then you realize that there's real cultural conflict and you can't all get along side by side because those disagreements are so fundamental that you basically, if you're going to work together and live together, you have to kind of come down on one, you have to make some decisions about, for example, whether women should work or whether you should have to show up on a time that is defined by your wristwatch.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a great point. Stanley Fish has an article called Boutique Multiculturalism, and he writes that most multiculturalists in the United States are what he calls boutique multiculturalists, and they have a sort of a boutique-y idea of what culture is, food, dance, and so forth. It's easy to support.
Yeah.
You have your dance, I have my dance, you have your food, I can taste your food at a festival, and we can all get along pretty well. But once we start recognizing that you may have fundamentally different ideas about what's right and wrong in the world,
yeah.
You know, the example of women's roles is a perfect example. You know, so for example, we're having wars right now in the Middle East over the role of women in some ways, you know, because one group has one idea about the place of women, and that may not conform to our idea about what women's role should be. So we go to war over it.
And another thing like that is nature. What is the role of nature? I mean, if you have a materialist view, you see it as a resource to be used and exploited. If you have a sacred view, then it's all alive. And those two things are not compatible.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've both evolved over time, too. So even Western ideas about nature have changed pretty significantly from nature being something that needs to be dominated, exploited, to the sort of conservationist wilderness idea of nature as being something sacred that should be protected. And of course, in the West, we see all kinds of battles being fought over those different conceptions of nature right now.
So you have written this book called Recognizing Heritage, The Politics of Multiculturalism in New Mexico. And in New Mexico, we have the kind of myth of the tricultural identity. And identity itself is something that you really call into question in your book.
Well, I think identity is complicated. And I think that it's also very politicized. So I'm really interested in this book in exploring the politics surrounding identity, to what extent governments can support different identities. We can't support all identities in our country. Some of them we consider to be abhorrent. So I think identity has been incredibly contentious throughout New Mexico's double colonial history.
And so you have, for example, as you write about, the Native American and Hispanic cultures, which have been studied by anthropologists, curated by museum curators. They are kind of colorful and interesting as cultures in that narrower sense that you were talking about before. And in a funny way, as you write, the Anglo-American identity is less studied and stays in the background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I call the politics of visibility. I argue that some groups of people here in New Mexico are more visible than others when it comes to public culture, public history, and heritage projects. And I think that in one way, colonizers can enforce their power by making themselves visible and by erasing the presence of the people they're colonizing. So, for example, colonizers go in and they tear down all the statues of the heroes that a group of people had, and they replace them with statues of their own heroes. Or they rewrite the history books to take out all the figures predating the colonial period and replacing them with, for example, American heroes. I think something a little bit different has happened in New Mexico, where Anglos came in and pretty early on in the early 1900s began celebrating Hispanic and Indian cultures. So, for example, the creation of the Museum of New Mexico is a good example of that. The creation of the Spanish colonial art movement. And what I argue in the book is that we have this sort of unequal visibility, such that Indians and Nuevo Mexicanos are highly visible in cultural productions here. We celebrate their culture. If you pick up a tourism brochure about New Mexico, you will see lots about Native American culture, not very much about Anglo culture. And while that seems to support Nuevo Mexicano and Indian communities, I argue that it actually ties those communities to the past, whereas Anglos are sort of assumed to occupy New Mexico's present and to be in charge of its future. And I think that's an unjust inequality.
I was reading about what you were saying in your book, but then I thought, well, what about Georgia O'Keeffe? What about John Gaumin? What about the Taos artists, all the many people who are all over the tourist brochures and have contributed to New Mexico's culture?
Yeah, that's definitely true. There are a number of famous Anglos who you can encounter as a tourist in New Mexico. You know, if you think about the Taos artist and think about what they were painting, they were a lot of times painting Indians.
Yeah, and landscapes and each other. And
that's true. But the reason they came to New Mexico was because they wanted to escape what they considered to be the alienation of industrial capitalism in the Northeast or the Midwest. And they really idealized Indian and Nuevo Mexicano communities. That was one of the major reasons why they came here. So you're absolutely right that there are certainly some famous Anglos. I would suspect that if you interviewed a tourist on the street in Santa Fe, I bet 95% of them at least would not know who John Gaumin is.
But they'd know who O'Keeffe was.
Yeah, probably.
And then you also, I mean, when you talk about it, I'm just asking you because I'm trying to understand what you're getting at in your book, but when you talk about how the Anglo culture sets itself up as the modern, present, and future, whereas the but we have a Hispanic governor, we have a Hispanic mayor, we have a large percentage of Hispanic legislature. I mean, this is a very active, living culture, and you can say, or population. I mean, it's not, we're hardly relics of the past.
That's absolutely true, and I think New Mexico can take pride in that fact. And Hispanics have always played a very important role in New Mexico politics. So I'm really writing about the cultural sector, museums, cultural programs, historic preservation projects. There are whole other sectors, for example, the educational system, electoral politics, that I don't really talk very much about in my book.
So you have studied the Northern Rio Grande heritage area. First of all, what is meant by a heritage area? This is a kind of a new concept in doing conservation.
Yeah. National heritage areas are a fairly new model of conservation. They really emerged in the 1980s. And they are designated by Congress. They are both areas, places, and administrative frameworks, and they provide a way for local communities to partner with the federal government to conserve culture, do some historic preservation, environmental protection, economic development, recreation, education. So they're very holistic, which is one of the characteristics of new conservation models. They're also community-based, so the management of the heritage area comes from local communities rather than from the top down. But there are partnerships, so there are partnerships between the private sector and the public sector.
So what does that look like here in New Mexico?
In 2006, Congress established the Northern Rio Grande National Heritage Area, which covers three counties, Taos, Santa Fe, and Rio Arriba. And a lot of the heritage areas, I think there are 49 of them in the United States now, a lot of them have themes. And so the theme of this heritage area here is the 400-year coexistence of Indian and Hispanic peoples. So Congress and the National Park Service, as well as many local communities here in New Mexico, were looking for ways to help communities conserve their cultures, promote their cultural distinctiveness, and also do some economic development, because, of course, there are a lot of pretty poor communities here. So the heritage area provides a framework for linking economic development with cultural projects.
And what are the specifics in this particular area? Like, what are the economic development projects look like? What does the conservation look like?
Well, a lot of the heritage areas integrate economic development and culture through tourism promotion. So developing museums, cultural sites, tourist routes. Of course, tourism is something that a lot of New Mexicans are pretty ambivalent about. A lot of New Mexicans feel like we don't really want any more tourists. We're already inundated by tourists. Whole towns have been given over to tourism. Santa Fe is a pretty good example of that. So there's a lot of ambivalence about tourism in New Mexico, and I think the folks here working on the heritage area argue that they can help communities manage tourism and also do some other economic development projects. So, for example, the heritage area folks are giving out small grants to communities to do all kinds of things like preservation, farmers market development, school projects, video projects. They produced a film. So it's a pretty holistic and comprehensive kind of project. And it's really community-driven. That's the main idea.
And in your view as an anthropologist, how's it working out?
I think it's a little early to say. This is a project that has really just begun. Everything takes a long time in New Mexico to develop. It's a complicated part of the country. So I think it's a little early to say how this project is going to work out. I'm hopeful that it will help communities in a grassroots kind of way. I also think that there's a long history of heritage preservation projects, and I write about several of them in my book, that have inadvertently helped to reinforce some colonial power relations in New Mexico. So I'm cautious about this project, but I'm also optimistic, and I'm friends with a bunch of the people who are working on this project, so I wish them the best.
You write about, there's a whole chapter on the politics of preservation in Las Trampas, and that's an area where basically the voice of defining what a place is was kind of taken away from the people who lived there. Tell us that story.
Sure, that chapter is about the 20th century history of historic preservation in Trompas, which is a village that has, it's a tiny village along the high road to Taos. It's a tiny village that has attracted Anglos really since the 19th century. Anglos have been fascinated with the adobe architecture of Trompas. And preservationist really dominated the representation of the village throughout the 20th century. They had the resources and the ability to write articles, publish books, take photographs of the village, and really control the way in which the village was represented. And so I sort of trace that history and argue that there's sort of two dominant themes that emerge in this body of literature. One portrays Las Trompas as an isolated, timeless village that hasn't changed at all. This is a very romantic image of Trompas that really reassures Anglos. I suggest that American colonization wasn't that bad and that these communities have survived, and therefore there's not very much to worry about. The other image is that this is a dying village where young people are leaving, the architecture is changing, and something has to be done. And this is an image of the village that justifies Anglo interventions into village life. So I think both of those two ways of describing and representing the village have had material consequences in terms of how they have justified Anglo interventions into village life.
What kind of interventions have happened there?
Well, the most interesting example came in the 1960s when the state was proposing to pave the highway that passed through Las Trompas. At that time, it was a graded country road that was pretty precarious after storms and during the winter. And the villagers were desperate for a better school bus route, better access to the outside world. So the state came up with this proposal to pave the highway. And if you've ever driven by Las Trompas on your way to Taos, you've driven on the road that got actually put in. Well, preservationists were alarmed by this proposal. They thought that it would ruin the character of the village. They thought that it might damage the church, San Jose de Gracia there. They thought that it was going to really change the quality of life in this village. So they very powerfully intervened to bring the conversation out of Las Trompas. They shifted the conversation from one about Trompas and its needs to one about the heritage, cultural heritage of the state and even the nation. So they ratcheted the conversation up to the national level, got the Secretary of the Interior involved. They basically stopped the road project from happening, even though the villagers themselves were very unanimously in support of it. Eventually, there were some architects here in Santa Fe who said, hey, maybe the National Park Service could just buy the whole valley and turn it into a living national monument. That would be one way to preserve it. And so that never happened, but that series of events in the 1960s is, I think, really fascinating and incredibly arrogant on the part of a preservationist.
What finally happened with the road?
Well, eventually the National Historic Preservation Act had just been passed. That was 1966. And the Historic Preservation Act required that the federal government work with communities that and state governments to protect historic resources. So what happened is that they got the Church of San Jose de Gracia and the whole village of Las Trompas designated as National Historic Landmarks, which brought it under the purview of the Historic Preservation Act. The state government, the preservationists, the federal government got together and finally came up with a compromise. John Conran called it the Treaty of Santa Fe, where they agreed upon a scaled-down road that sort of made everybody happy. Conran said that it was a 75% victory for preservationists.
And how do people feel about it now, who are living in Las Trompas, I mean?
You know, that's a great question, and that's a funny story. I, as an anthropologist, as an Anglo outsider, have not been able to really engage with Trompaseños in my research. I was pretty ambivalent about doing research in the village itself because I knew how much I knew about this long history of Anglos interfering and invading people's privacy. I was pretty sensitive about those issues. I also knew that anthropologists in particular have a very long history of invading people's privacy and violating their interest and their desires. So I very tentatively tried to do a little bit of field work in the village of Las Trampas, and not very successfully. I eventually, this is a long story, but I'll make it short. Eventually had the opportunity to tour the church with the mayordoma of the church, and she was very friendly and answered some of my questions, but made it clear that after that brief tour that it would be inappropriate for me to ask any more questions or to be nosy and to really try to get more information out of the village. And that was a message that I respected. These people just really want to be left alone, and they don't need me. And therefore, I am not a very good person to answer that question about what's going on in the village today and what people think. I would encourage people to ask residents themselves if they have that opportunity.
Very interesting. We're talking to Thomas Guthrie about his book, Recognizing Heritage, The Politics of Multiculturalism in New Mexico. And it's funny because when you write about and talk about the way anthropologists and preservationists and so on are treating people of New Mexico villages, for all the world, it sounds like the way anthropologists treat rainforest tribes people. You know, like they are living in a timeless reality, you know, which is, I mean, people look at Amazonian rainforest Indians and think that because they're living in nature now, they've always lived that way, not realizing that every culture changes.
Yeah, there's plenty of room for critiquing the history of anthropology. It's a discipline that really grew out of European colonialism.
Yeah.
Anthropologists were the people who went to the colonies and studied the people that were getting colonized. And that's a complicated relationship. Anthropologists have, in very important ways, challenged colonialism and ethnocentrism. And that's a part of my disciplinary history that I'm very proud of and I think is very important. But at the same time, we have oftentimes inadvertently reproduced a lot of stereotypes and misunderstandings, and we've claimed the ability and the right to represent people. And as you say, oftentimes that has meant relegating them to a timeless past.
We're talking to anthropologist Thomas Guthrie about his book, Recognizing Heritage, The Politics of Multiculturalism in New Mexico. Now, one of the words that also comes up in your book is the word authenticity, which is used with respect to art and culture by people who are basically running institutions and organizations of one kind or another, whether it be museums or other cultural institutions. Does that word have any meaning? How is it used? What's wrong with it?
I think there's a lot of concern in New Mexico about cultural authenticity, and I think that concern comes from both the effects of colonization, the rapid social change that has happened, especially in the 20th century and the 21st century, as communities are really concerned about losing their cultural identities. It also comes from the extent to which tourism is so highly developed here. Tourists are many times concerned with authenticity, and there's also a fear that tourism negates authenticity, that if you go to a place that's touristy, it's not the real thing.
Right.
So there are a lot of reasons why people have anxieties about authenticity in New Mexico.
One of the things, I mean, just to interrupt you for a second, it's one thing to make sure that the clay pot you bought is from the Pueblo and not from China. I mean, that's one kind of authenticity.
Right, absolutely. That's there have been laws passed to ensure that kind of thing. So, for example, if anybody went and bought some artwork from underneath the portal at the Palace of the Governors here in Santa Fe, they could be assured that the art that they bought was produced by the people selling it, that it was produced by Native Americans living here in New Mexico. That's important to tourists. And I know a lot of Native communities are really concerned about, fakes coming in from other parts of the world. The authenticity I'm really interested in is a more abstract kind of authenticity that has to do with identity and culture. I think there's a lot of pressure on Indian and Nuevo Mexicano communities here to orient their lives to the past. They're oftentimes rewarded when they perform tradition. And there are disincentives for doing things like using computers or dressing in blue jeans or working in offices, which is, it's the 21st century, you know, we're all living in a capitalist economy, and as you say, all cultures change. So I get concerned when authenticity gets used in a way that constrains people and puts pressure on them to orient their lives to the past.
Do people really end up doing that? I mean, have you met people who decline to use a computer or a cell phone because they've got pressure to be authentic?
Well, I'll put it this way. I think in a lot of communities, there are conversations going on within the community itself about what it means to be Indian and who's a real Indian. I found that in my study of the Portal market at the Palace of the Governors, there were internal conversations going on about what does it mean to produce Indian art? What is Indian art? Who is a real Indian? I think a lot of Hispanics here in New Mexico are having really serious conversations about how important is the Spanish language for our identity. What does it mean that we have kids now growing up not speaking Spanish? I think that's a real concern within Hispanic communities.
There's a lot of issues, as you write, that are overlooked in conversations about multiculturalism. So we focus on food and dance and cultural expression, but we don't focus on some of the really important issues that have to do with colonialism and the imposition of one culture over another, namely land and water.
That's right. I think that to a large extent, the culture industry here in New Mexico has deflected attention away from political issues, especially land and water. So the more we celebrate cultural survival, cultural diversity, the less we are talking about some real fundamental political and economic issues that are very important to communities. I found this in my research on Las Trampas. A lot of the preservationists were very, very happy to celebrate architecture and folklife and religion and music, but they completely ignored the devastating land loss that the village had suffered as the Las Trampas land grant was broken up.
It's interesting because, I mean, there was a quotation in your book by somebody who was a veteran who was basically saying, yeah, I'm allowed to go fight and die for my country, but I'm not allowed to graze my cow on my ancestral land.
Yeah, that's a great example of how identity and citizenship are so contentious here, access to natural resources. I use that quote to get at some of the complex questions that are being asked about what does it mean to be American?
Yeah.
So that veteran was making the point that I'm an American citizen, I'm considered fully American when it comes to fighting wars. And there are plenty of folks in northern New Mexico who have very long, proud histories of serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. But maybe I'm not so American when it comes to accessing national forests, which are, after all, supposed to belong to all of us Americans.
Yeah, and which belonged to my ancestors before the United States ever got here.
Absolutely.
It also brings up questions about what America means, because people who live in Peru consider themselves Americans. People who live in Mexico consider themselves Americans.
Absolutely. And I I started asking questions. I was interested in why is the federal government creating this national heritage area? What does that mean? And I started wondering, is this a neo-colonial act? Is this the federal government finally trying to consolidate its claim to this region that's been very contentious since the mid-19th century? And so I started asking people, you know, what does it mean to say that this is American heritage? And it was funny because while I thought I was being kind of a hip anti-colonial anthropologist, a lot of the folks that I talked to said, no, Tom, you're really on the wrong track here, because this is America. And it's America in a continental sense. It's always been America in that continental sense. So the term America is an ambiguous term. Sometimes we use it to refer to the United States, but sometimes we use it to refer to two continents. And I think that ambiguity gives people a lot of room for making political moves that are really interesting.
You have written this whole book about New Mexico from an anthropological perspective, and you bring up these questions of basically land and water and social justice. What are your hopes for this book in opening conversations in those areas?
There are three ways in which I think dominant forms of multiculturalism here in New Mexico have inadvertently reinforced colonial hierarchies. I try to lay those out and give examples of them in the book. And then I suggest three ways for turning those around. So, first of all, I suggest that rather than focusing so exclusively on Indians and Nuevo Mexicanos and cultural programs here, we need to broaden the conversation, bring Anglos back into the history of New Mexico so that we are able to think and talk critically about the legacy of American colonization. So I think we need to render Anglos more visible in New Mexico public culture and history so that we can start to recognize that Anglos are culturally and historically particular actors, and that therefore that history of colonization is something that we can think critically about.
There's also, if I may say so, a lot more common cause that could be made. In other words, farmers, whatever their racial history, really are thinking about collecting seeds and doing kind of restorative agriculture and sustainable agriculture. And I mean, if you look at this world today, in a way, the lines aren't drawn between one race and another. The lines are drawn between the people with big money and ordinary people. And ordinary people are of all races.
Well, I think we as human beings draw all kinds of lines on according to all kinds of different criteria. But my new research is focusing on efforts to revitalize agriculture in northern New Mexico. And I think you're right that the local food movement, the revitalization of small-scale farming, is creating interesting opportunities for breaking down some of those ethnic and racial boundaries. And I think they're great examples of that. The seed sovereignty and food sovereignty movement is a really good example of that, where we see all kinds of different people coming together around land and water and agriculture issues and really kind of casting the enemy here as the big multinational corporations.
Now, I interrupted you, but there were two other ways that you would like to bring the conversation forward.
So the first way is to bring Anglos back into view in public history and culture. Once that happens, I think we can repoliticize culture so that culture no longer deflects attention away from politics but becomes a way of talking about it. So that we can start talking about the relationship between heritage and culture and politics and their colonial context. So that's the second way, is to repoliticize culture and heritage. Whereas I think in the past, culture and heritage have really deflected attention away from political and economic realities. And the third thing that I encourage people to start thinking about in New Mexico is to really stop worrying so much about cultural authenticity. I think it's a complicated concept that is not very helpful. Like I said, I think that the concept of authenticity is a concept that gets stuck to some groups and not others. I once had a student in a class point out to me, it was a class about Native North America, and he said, you know, why is it the white people there's never any pressure on white people to still go around in horses and buggies like their ancestors did? You know, that kind of pressure is put on Indians all the time. Right, so I suggest let's displace this concept of authenticity and make space for communities to determine their own future with creativity and innovation in whatever way that they think is best for their community.
You said something a moment ago which I'd like to explore, which is to repoliticize culture. What does that look like? What would be an example of repoliticizing culture?
Well, I'll give you a good example. In the 1990s, there was a pretty serious conflict going on between traditional land users in northern New Mexico and environmentalists and state land managers. So this related to the land grant struggle. It related to the conservation of national forest. And a lot of Nuevo Mexicano land grant activists found that they were typically more successful when they presented themselves as a traditional endangered culture. rather than when they framed their conflict in terms of race or class. They were more successful at winning Anglo support when they presented themselves as a traditional indigenous or quasi-indigenous culture. And there was a protest that happened that I think is a great example of how culture can be very politicized. There were some folks who came down to the roundhouse and were protesting Forest Service policies. And they had traditional weavers and artists and healers and woodcutters displaying their traditional wares. And then behind them, they had a big banner on the wall that said something like, without justice, there will be no peace. So it was an explicitly political statement that they were making, but they were also taking advantage of this support that people often give to groups that they consider to be traditional and endangered cultures.
How did that come out?
Well, as you probably know, this is a struggle that is still ongoing today. These struggles over the national forest in New Mexico are still ongoing. I think things have died down a little bit since the 90s when the conflicts were so intense. But, and there are a number of groups. I think Tierra Wolves is a great example. It's a weaving cooperative up in Los Ojos that I think has really been, it's spun off of an organization called Ganados del Valle, which was really at the forefront of this controversy. And, you know, I think that they're doing really great work now. You can go to the Santa Fe Farmers Market and see what they're selling, and they're really doing solid work at conserving natural resources, at providing some economic development for local communities. It's just a really great group. So I take some heart in what I see happening today, although I think the struggles over natural resources are definitely still ongoing.
I think it's also really tricky because Northern New Mexico is really within living memory. If you think about the elders that are still with us, we have the living memory of a subsistence culture, but we're no longer living in a subsistence culture, and nobody really wants to. Nobody wants to farm all their food, make all their clothing, haul all their water, and not be part of the kind of petroleum-driven industrial system in which we live, because that provides comforts and benefits of various kinds, like communications and transportation and TV, you know, entertainment, and things like that. And so, I mean, I think to talk more explicitly about what kind of best of both worlds we really want is an important conversation, because it seems like when we want some of the benefits of industrial society, we're kind of forced to have to take all the horrors with it, like climate change and the utter destruction of our waterways and soil and all of that.
Right. That's really what my new research is focusing on. I'm here for a year doing new research on agricultural revitalization, and I'll tell you what, there are so many exciting projects happening here where people are really starting to realize that we cannot continue on this path that we're on now. The crisis of climate change, the crisis of peak oil and resource depletion, the economic instability that we're facing as a country and as a world, people are just recognizing that our industrialized capitalist system is not sustainable in any way. And so all kinds of alternatives are cropping up. And people, you're right, here in New Mexico, there are people who can remember other ways of living. And I think we're at a really crucial moment in the United States that we still have people who lived through the Great Depression and through World War II, when our economies and our cultures were structured in very different ways. So I see all kinds of people trying to revitalize home economies. I've worked with a couple of groups here who are really doing amazing work trying to get people to start growing your own food, canning your own food, making your own clothes, all kinds of small-scale agriculture, reinvigorating barter economies. So New Mexico has always been a place where alternative culture has thrived, and I see that really now with the local food movement and agricultural revitalization going on.
Your work also really brings up questions about colonialism and redistribution. So when somebody basically takes all the wealth and everybody's left, you know, maybe bartering and doing subsistence and all the things you're talking about, but basically kind of working with the leftover crumbs, that in itself is a problem. And as I'm sure many of our listeners have read and you've read, there was a study sponsored by NASA that just came out that basically said that without massive redistribution of resources, we are endangering civilization itself on a planetary scale. And New Mexico is just one part of that.
Yeah, there. In the history of social justice movements, there's sort of two tracks. One, we can call the politics of redistribution, and the other, the politics of recognition. And that's something that I'm interested about in my book, because I argue that in New Mexico, pursuing the politics of recognition, in other words, trying to get your culture, your people's history recognized by the federal government, people have been very successful at that. In fact, the Heritage Area is a great example of the recognition of different cultures. But sometimes the politics of recognition can distract from the politics of redistribution. And I think it's important to integrate those two things. It's oftentimes easier to talk about recognition than it is to talk about redistribution, because redistribution gets into all kinds of questions about land and water that are really difficult to answer. So that's one of the things that I argue for, is trying to reintegrate redistribution and recognition.
Well, and as, I mean, getting back to what you said at the beginning, if you talk about recognition in terms of culture, what we eat and how we dance and what our songs are, that's kind of easy in comparison to the big questions, because nobody has to give anything up.
Absolutely. I think that culture is a pretty non-threatening thing to talk about, or at least it's become that way. It doesn't have to be, but it's become that way.
So when we start talking about redistribution, which is an international problem, and it's a huge national problem in the United States, where the top 0.01% own just ridiculously disproportionate resources and wealth and income and all of that stuff. What does that mean for us here in New Mexico? How do we think about redistribution?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. It's a certainly complicated one. You know, I think the first step is just to acknowledge the inequality. I think that's something that we try to sweep under the carpet a lot, and to start having conversations about what a just society would look like and how resources are distributed. What does it mean to live in a city like Santa Fe that has such incredible wealth and also such incredible poverty? How can we justify that? How can we change it? And I think there are really interesting conversations happening on the south side of Santa Fe now, for example, about some of these issues. I think the questions surrounding public lands, concerning Los Alamos, which has been such a, which has generated such wealth and also such disparity and environmental degradation in New Mexico. I think those kind of conversations are really important. I don't have any easy solutions or answers, but I think the more we can talk about it, the more we can start to think about alternatives.
So, Thomas Guthrie, you are here, you're on sabbatical, you're doing research in New Mexico for a year. Can we expect another book from you next year or sometime in the future?
Definitely not next year. This book that I just published took 11 years from the time I started the research to the time that I finished it. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm enjoying learning, and we'll see where it goes.
Thomas Guthrie is an anthropologist and sociologist. He's a professor at Guilford College, and he's author of the book Recognizing Heritage, The Politics of Multiculturalism in New Mexico. He will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Wednesday, at 6 in the evening, signing copies and talking about his book. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.